every story is more interesting when it's just truthfully told. And that's life, right? That's the sort of human element of the whole thing, which is, you know, you're not living life unless you experience a setback or make a mistake. That's how you grow. That's how you learn and how you ultimately get tested to push harder.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of our podcast, Partners in Time. Today, I'm joined by a very good friend of mine in IWC, James Marsden, accomplished actor, watch aficionado, all-round petrol head and everything else. And honestly, and this is something, James, I have to say, you're probably one of the most gentlemanly gentlemen I've ever met in my entire life.
See, this is why I like talking with you, because all I get is praise.
Exactly.
And it's completely inaccurate across the board. No,
it is not.
Very, very kind of you to say. That's very nice of you.
No, because you know why I know that? Because I have, being in this job, I had the very insightful privilege of meeting many of our brand ambassadors before I got into this job. Because I did Geneva and I did a lot of the fairs.
That's right.
At SIHH back in the day. And I can't put my finger exactly on what year it would have been when I first met you, but you were wearing a navy blue jumper, like sweater in American, with a red horizontal stripe across the middle. And I would guess it would have been 2014, 15, something like that.
Yeah, I think that was it. I think you were kind enough to take me on a tour of the facilities there before you'd moved to the new manufacturer. Because I remember that sweater and I remember seeing the photographs of you and I walking through the halls together.
Yeah, but it would have been good memory. Even before that, it would have been in Geneva at one of the SIHH booths. Maybe I've got the sweater desynced. But anyway,
well, no, I think I have a tendency to reuse my sweaters.
But you have one sweater. This is the sustainability attitude we're looking for. You know,
I don't wash them either, just so everyone can remember my smell.
No, that's
funny. Yes, it was. I remember. I think it was 2015, somewhere
it
around then.
I have a distinct memory. It was Portuguesa, which would have been 2015. So that makes sense.
Right.
And you know, it's just, it's always the way you are with everybody you meet, you know, independent of job title and sponsorship and everything else. It just, you know, that left a lasting impression on me. And you were just all around such a fantastic person with absolutely everybody. So respectful, so humble.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. I know I joke quite a bit, but when I hear things like that and from people that I respect like yourself, it's just it reminds me I'm doing something right. And
yeah, exactly.
So I appreciate that.
The story continued very much like that. And of course, you know, you are an absolutely fantastically accomplished actor. You're one of very, very, very few, very, 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 very good actors, which has been recognized many times. But I think what's really interesting with you, you've done a huge journey in terms of genres and media channels and all the rest of it, because you've been both in independent films, you've been in comedies, you've been in big studio productions, from X-Men, you've been on HBO with Westworld, you've moved on to things in Netflix, you've done Disney. I think you're there's even a Disney Plus release, right, of the Enchanted sequel coming, etc. So all the way to Sonic, and it's a huge range. So how did that go? How did you find your way into acting? And then what's the journey been for you, and what's sort of the key sort of conclusions for you having worked across so many different types of entertainment?
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for saying all that. I'm very proud of this sort of longevity that I've found in this in this industry. I didn't expect it, to be honest, completely honest with you, when I started about almost 30 years ago. You know, I come from pretty humble beginnings back in Oklahoma City and didn't come from much. And I didn't feel like I was ever really, I was going to say good at anything else other than the performing arts, like music and acting. But I think there was nothing else I was passionate about at the time. I was surrounded by people who were, you know, going the sort of normal route that everyone goes down, which is finish high school, go to college, get a degree and work in an office. And that just didn't sound appealing to me. I think I was a little naive to think that I could move to Los Angeles and have this kind of career, but here I am and it's extraordinary. And I every day I wake up and I'm grateful that I'm, you know, still invited to the table. And like you said, over a broad range of genres, you know, I that wasn't planned. It's very, I sort of stumbled into it as the sort of, you know, Swiss Army knife of actors, which is a title that I'm actually, you know, getting comfortable with, because it means you can stay around, you have staying power. And I'm just very grateful for that. So it really started with, you know, I was 18, 19 years old, and I was faced with the reality of, you know, you got to get serious and figure out what you want to do with your life. And I had heard from enough people, after a few stage plays and musicals that I did in high school and 1 year of college that, that I was quote unquote talented. and I was just, again, sort of young and, confident enough to believe it. And so I packed
which is,
up and
which is an important quality, by the way.
Yeah. And don't you, like when you get older, right? I'm 47 years old now. And now any choice I make terrifies me, right? Yeah. Don't you want to get back that sort of confidence, that sort of blind confidence you had when you were young, where you aren't,
that you know it all.
It's pretty exactly. Right. As long, but keep your ego in check, right? But have the confidence to actually be, and the courage to take chances. And the first thing people ask me is, was it scary for you to uproot yourself from Oklahoma and pack up your, you know, 1984 Honda Accord and drive to Los Angeles
Now you dropped a bombshell. A Honda Accord.
Yeah, there we go. Like, yeah, it was...
Put you more into like a Civic Type R or something like that.
Yeah, well, I
CRX.
Couldn't...
CRX would have been the one.
There we go. There. Right, yeah, the Honda CRX. Remember that unique design that with that sort
cool.
of... Looked like Foxy a like a kid's shoe, yeah,
exactly.
like a toddler's shoe.
Sketches, definitely.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and they're all back now, right? The '80s and '90s cars. Yeah, well, that's a whole. Don't get me started on automotive.
No, exactly.
But yeah, the car before that, actually, I was 19. So when I was 16, was a 1986 Pontiac Firebird. So there was a little sport in there, with a V8, 350 V8. But the Honda was that broke down, the Firebird. So yeah. I had to get something more sensible, which
is JDM. Here we go. Exactly.
If I'm going to make it to California, if I'm going to make it there, I need to have a Honda. And not a Pontiac. It was a sensible move just to get me there. But it was like, I have nothing to lose. You know, I was excited by the idea of transplanting myself to Los Angeles. And it was like, what do I have to lose? And my father said, you know, I'll help support you, you know, for living expenses and things like that so that you can focus on this. And I'll do that for 1 year. And if it doesn't pan out, then think about coming back and going to school and, you know, getting a real job. And he didn't say that. He was very supportive, and both my parents were. And I got very lucky. I was set up with a manager who was legitimate and sending me out on auditions 4 times a day. And again, it was that just sort of like, you know, cock of the walk attitude of I'm the next big thing. And I'm gonna will this to happen.
Yeah.
And so I started booking small jobs here and there. It was a guest spot on, you know, The Nanny or Saved by the Bell or Party of Five, these sort of, you know, teen sitcoms or TV shows. And then I got offered to be on a soap opera, which was like, you have to sign a 3-year contract, and which to me is like, hey, I got guaranteed work for 3 years. And my manager said, no, you don't want to do that right now because you don't want to lock yourself in. We're getting a lot of good feedback from you. And my father was like, wait, what? In 2 months in, he's turning down jobs already?
Have you even got a job, son?
as an actor. But then he relayed to my father and myself that, you know, let's curate this and start to be picky about the kind of work you do. And I realized that that's one of the paths to the sort of longevity that I've found, which is, you know, really be, careful in the type of work that you go after. And it's always that balance, right? It's like, you have to pay your mortgage. You have to, you know, it's your livelihood. You have to, you know, put food on the table, but you also want to be careful about the kind of work that you do. And you want to surround yourself with, talented individuals and interesting stories and interesting characters. And I think by doing that, I think that's why I'm sort of still around. And I've learned along the way, you know, that you learn so much along the way and you sort of hone your skills and you get better, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's also the difference between sort of just raw impulsive talent and actually a level of professionalism. Right? You know, when you say Swiss Army knife, it means that you can adapt to different situations and actually deliver rather than being just extremely good at one thing. But then,
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I don't always think about it that way, but it's true. It's like that's a whole other talent unto itself, is sort of figuring out one, how the industry works, and two, how do you adapt to what they want to see, or what's out there? But for the longest time, it was whatever script, whatever audition that I booked, that was my, when people asked me like, why did you choose to do that? And I said, well, because I got the job. Yeah. I would say, I auditioned for it and they gave me the job.
It's good enough.
Yeah, but you were so wrong for it. I know, but hey, they paid me. So, but this is the early days. Yeah.
My LA dream got shattered a lot sooner than that. So I didn't pack up a Hyundai in Oklahoma. I packed up a suitcase on Virgin Atlantic coming out of Horsham, West Sussex at the time to do my gap year in Santa Monica. At a hotel design company doing something very interesting I hadn't come across before. And that is sort of mass designing Caribbean resort hotels.
Wow.
But it's a conveyor belt of hotel design. It was quite an eye-opener for me. So here I came with my European architectural visions and, great big LA and thinking, this is a similar thing, I'm bringing all the creative quality that America has ever looked for.
Right.
And then obviously producing quite a hard landing in Santa Monica, not being able to find a place. I think my mum and dad had booked me into what appeared to be a respectable student hostel and turned out to be quite the dive. Sort of bunk beds and eight to a room and people sort of sitting in the hallways sort of eating stuff out of bowls and stuff. It was wild. And I came sort of with my two suitcases of all my best suits thinking, hello, I'd like to check in, please.
And, and they looked at you like, you don't belong here, sir.
Yeah. So I traded the Honda. Actually, I had a rental contract with a place called Rent a Dent, which was
I remember that. How did I've seen that place before. I think I probably used their services once or twice.
I think it was a Hyundai. This thing didn't work. It made the most horrendous noises. And the whole thing was just an absolute disaster from start to finish. And they told me I was going to work in the library, which I thought was going to be, this grand library where I happened to have a desk. Of course, what they meant is you're going to be sorting the sample library of fabrics for this Caribbean resort.
Oh, the old bait and switch, right?
Exactly.
Isn't it funny how you have these just amazing, your imagination runs wild with what it's going to look like.
Exactly. I think
and you arrive. It's kind of like looking at those Caribbean hotels online, right?
Amazing.
Yeah, all expense paid. Look at these. They have the most beautiful photographs. You show up and like, this is not exactly what I had in mind.
And then basically my first working day, a sort of chap came in with a big sample suitcase. And I remember to the present day, he threw this thing of fabric over the desk and went, this is a new Raoul. We can now print on Trevira. And at this point, I knew I was done there.
How long were you there for? How long did this...
10 days.
10 days.
I have to. And then basically my dear wife, Paula, she was cabin crew at the time, sort of relatively newly in love back then, and she flew in Virgin Atlantic, and she saw me and we caught up when she had a flight out to LA, and she said, you look absolute shit. Like, I have to get you back home. This is terrible. And that flight was completely overbooked, and I remember this was on some airport boulevard, Hilton something, and I actually knocked on the captain's door at 10 p.m. and he looked at me as well, and he obviously felt a great deal of pity, and he says, son, whatever happens, we're going to take you home tomorrow. And they take me September the 11th, they took me back in the jump seat in the cockpit all the way back to Heathrow.
You're kidding me. Wow. In the cockpit.
Yes. Oh, wow. It's not bad ending.
What a great story.
Yeah, exactly.
No. On an overbooked flight. That's so interesting. Wow.
You're not here to talk about my LA story.
Well, it was a brief one, wasn't it?
It was very,
10 days.
I returned some years later, and then, having won the first design accolade award for my first boutique endeavor.
I would say you made the right decision. Yeah, that was a good choice to get back on that plane. Oh, well, hopefully you had better experiences from then on out.
Yeah,
in Los Angeles. Yeah.
It's a city that takes a bit of getting used to in the way that it's quite unique in the way it works. Huh?
It really does. I mean, I moved here in 1993, as I was illustrating before, and it's changed so much since then. I mean, when I started out, it was like the feeling was there was a handful of people here that you were competing against for some of these roles. And now it's like, it's changed so much. I wouldn't know how to tell a young person how to get into this industry now. I wouldn't even, back in when I started, it was literally you have headshots and you go knocking on door to, you know, agents' doors and leaving your headshots at the doors in with hopes that they, you know, represent, give you representation to send you out on auditions. And now it's just, I have no idea. I guess you start your own YouTube channel or, you know, get enough followers on something and then you'll get hired. I don't know how it works, but you know, over the course of, you know, 28 years, I just, like I said before, I, you know, started to get more, judicious about my choices and the type of work I wanted to do. And that sort of blossomed into, you know, more opportunities, and X-Men came along and it was like, you know, it was a windfall moment for me. It was just, I got so lucky to be a part of that and, you know, surrounded by some incredible people that I grew up, you know, admiring and watching in film. And, and then, you know, other things came along, like opportunities to use my voice in Hairspray and Enchanted and do some singing and things like that. And it was, you know.
We have to talk about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Well, we just finished, you know, not to sit here and just yap about myself, but we just finished the sequel of Enchanted for Disney Plus, literally 2 months ago, two months ago. We shot it in Dublin, Ireland, or outside of Dublin.
Yeah.
And it was 15 years since the first film. So it was a welcome opportunity to revisit these great, you know, beloved characters. And we thought it was, you know, it was never going to happen. So it was exciting to step back into the Prince Edward costume and be silly and have fun with Amy Adams and Idina Menzel and all the good friends and family from that. So that was, it's been an interesting year. I mean, last year, as we know, it's been, you know, so many things got, you know, put on hold and stopped completely. And then when we started opening back up, towards the beginning of this year or a few months into the year here in Los Angeles, you know, everything just went back online immediately. So it was the third season of Dead to Me on Netflix. Yeah. And we had to sort of squeeze Oh, thank you very much. I wish I could take credit for that. It's amazing, amazing women on that show and lucky to be a part of it. Great, fun character, playing two characters, actually twin brothers. So that was a challenge. That was something I'd never done before.
My only comment is first of all, as in many of these kind of, I have to be very careful now, I don't say the wrong thing, but in sort of roughly Mercedes-Benz associated productions, you then start to see a lot of Mercedes-Benz, literally almost every single car.
Oh, and then Dead to Me. Yes, yeah. They're everywhere.
And they're flawlessly clean under any circumstances, which I think if you're just about to sort of lose the plot and your life is all over the place, you've got kids to deal with, like all of the storyline to deal with, but then every morning your car is absolutely pristine.
right.
I have to have a word with Stuttgart.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting observation for sure. But someone's making sure that thing is spotless for sure.
Definitely. It's somewhere in the notes of the contract, I'm sure.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, yeah.
I just want to go back to Enchanted quickly again, because that's obviously been critically really acclaimed and sort of highly praised. And then you just mentioned Idina Menzel as well. I mean, was there a duet recorded at one point? Is that actually true?
Boy, did I let the cat out of the bag too soon? well, there is some singing. If I'm supposed to talk about this.
No, okay.
I keep
speculating. That's fine. Oh, no. You know, I mean, she's the lady who sang Frozen, Let It Go, right?
Yeah. Yes, she plays Elsa in Frozen. And the irony is, when we did the first film, you know, one of the most incredible voices of our time, Idina Menzel, had no musical number. Like, she was in the movie and didn't sing one note. We started to record a duet on the first film between myself and Idina, but then halfway through the recording, they realized where this musical number would fall is after the sort of climax of the movie and. You know, and
no more music.
Right. It was just like, we got to wrap this up. Like the movie's done. Amy Adams found her true love, you know, her true love and her prince and, you know, roll credits. And we don't have time for that. As much as they wanted to hear us sing together, it was the running time was already too long. So they figured that let's just save it for maybe the sequel if it happens. So maybe that happens this time around. We'll see.
If maybe that happens, then absolutely, definitely my two daughters writers will freak out.
If it happens, then, or if it doesn't happen, mm-hmm. either way, then we should get Adina on a phone call or a FaceTime or something with your daughters and see if
I was thinking more of you. I mean, it's, you know, it's
nope, can't do it. I can act it. I can get Adina to do it. She's my pawn,
charm,
right?
But Adina's like, I can't. It's a winner. It's an absolute
situation. Are you kidding? I'd love to do that. It's one of the, you know, people ask me to do that sometimes. Like, will you call and leave a little voice message or a little video for my daughter? I know you get asked this a lot. I'm like, absolutely, of course. It's the easiest thing for me to do. And it's the simplest way to just create joy for somebody in, you know, 10, 15 seconds. It's just, I love doing it. And in fact, my daughter just turned 16 a month and a half ago, and Adina was kind enough to sing her a little happy birthday recording, and it's pretty cool. So we do this for each other, she owes me one. She owes me one. She's gonna sing for your daughters, damn it.
Birthday's the 31st of October, I remind you.
Okay, great. Oh wait, when is it again?
Halloween. 31st of October.
Oh, 31st. Okay, mm-hmm.
She's gonna be 10 as well. Double digit.
Yeah. Ah, very cool. Yeah. There
and
you
she's,
go.
She's sung it many times to my much suffering at home and in the car.
Oh, she did? The songs from Frozen?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, she was just the right age. I think she was probably three or something when Frozen came out first. And we've obviously been to every single sing-along hotel, New Year's party, kids dance thing.
Oh, so you know every word of the songs sing-along as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. I'm happy to admit it.
In fact, it's in your head now, and it'll be in your head for the rest of the day, won't it?
And literally every single year when we're out skiing and out in the snow, it still comes out that they do the whole Olaf line and I'll be a happy snowman, you know, every single time. So, long suffering.
That's great. Well, I hope that you and your daughters will enjoy the sequel. It's been a long time coming, but we're really proud of it. And Stephen Schwartz and Alan Menken did the music again. And if you don't know them, they did the music on the original, but Alan Menken did all the songs for Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. And Stephen Schwartz is, of course, responsible for Wicked with Adina. And so the music's phenomenal. And Adam Shankman directed it, who directed Hairspray. So it's strange that I worked with him on Hairspray. Now he'd come around and do the sequel to Enchanted. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm glad it happened. I think we need those types of movies nowadays, you know, we need some music and some uplifting, sort of joyful, material. So I was really lucky to be a part of it. And hopefully everyone will be enjoying it soon.
We cannot wait, especially with some other movies getting delayed all the time and time again.
Yeah, and the other film that I did this year, we sort of crammed it all into this year, was the sequel to Sonic the Hedgehog with Jim Carrey, and which was the last movie really to be able to be released in theaters before the pandemic hit.
Yeah, that's true.
So it was a big success, which, you know, we're really happy it was and proud of it. And it was like, maybe there was one or two films that came out in the theaters after, but that was it. But it managed to get enough eyes on it to merit a sequel, and we just finished shooting that this year as well. Mm-hmm. So it was like, okay, everything's back to normal. Let's let's go shoot Dead to Me, Enchanted, and Sonic, and
all this other thing.
Yeah, so it's been a busy year. So I'm really grateful, and I can't complain.
No, definitely. And that's obviously one of the points I wanted to talk to you about is the fact that, of course, we're going to go into that in just a second, but during the pandemic, all of the, you know, the questions about future of cinema and big screen and all the rest of it, the streaming services popping up left, right and center, everybody upping their ante as it was. And then, of course, I noticed it here in Europe that from literally 2 weeks to the next 2 weeks, it was from, oh my God, cinemas are basically bankrupt. This is never going to work, to, oh, we can't find enough ticket salespeople, and people are queuing, you know, six times around the block to get back into the theater. And it's just absolutely. So it seems to me like, although sort of a year ago on many fronts, we said, okay, it's never going to be the same again, and it's going to change forever. But then I'm not sure that really happened in the world of Hollywood. And I'd love to hear your view on all of this, because of course, Paramount has come with their streaming service. Disney Plus has been very successful in their first year. Netflix, has obviously built their position massively with Amazon and a few others. Disney, I think they've had some attempts at just releasing sort of streaming exclusively, but then people are taking it back to the cinema. What's your experience with all of this, and what's your view?
Well, yeah, I mean, my view is it was an evolution that was taking place anyway, albeit probably a little slower than I think the sort of migration to streaming, right? I think it was happening anyway, right? It wasn't. I'm not saying that they were, you know, that theaters were just going to be left in the dust, but it was going to be more a more balanced thing where you could go to the theaters if you so desired, but you also, you know, I think it was becoming about accessibility. You can watch these films and enjoy them however you want, right? You can watch it on your phone, you can watch it at home, you can go to the theater and have that shared experience. And the pandemic sort of just accelerated that, I think. You know, as it did with everything in our world, right? It was like, you know, meetings were now on Zoom at home, and we relied on technology to you know, whatever consume whatever TV shows or movies we wanted to watch. My view now, I mean, I you know, again, I'm just actor for hire, so I don't really know the ins and outs of what's on the horizon for the industry. But my feeling is, and what I hear people talking about, is that there will be a balance, right? Like, I don't think theaters will go away. You know, my guess is these giant companies like Netflix and Amazon and Disney will probably take ownership of some of these theaters. I mean, I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but they will then release their movies day and date at home. You can stream them, or you can go to the theater and have that experience as well. Maybe for a limited run or something. I think they're all just trying to figure it out, you know? But I think there was enough, like, I think Quiet Place 2 came out and did really well, and a few other films came out this year and surprised the industry, really. I forget the one that came out and actually made, I don't know, $60 million over a weekend in July when everyone felt safe enough to go back to the theaters. And it was like an absolute shock to everyone in the business that, you know, that there was still a strong desire to go back to normal and all these things that that we were denied over the last year, and a real pent up desire to get back to all these other things, these shared experiences we had before the pandemic. And so I do think that, you know, the movie, you know, the theater going experience is not going to die. I think there's always going to be an audience for that. And I think the two can sort of coexist. Mm. And that's my view, is that that's going to happen, right? You're going to get it however you want it, and maybe there'll be less theaters. I don't know, but
as an actor, do you have a preference? Like, when you produce work you're really proud of, do you want, you know, does it depend on what genre it is, or do you generally love for people to see it in theater? Or?
Well, if it's something I'm in and I'm having to watch it, I want the smallest screen available. So I like to watch all my films on the Apple iWatch.
From a distance.
I'm not great at sitting in a giant theater watching my, you know, my close up on a 70 foot screen. But I, you know, I really take the approach of however anybody wants to watch it, right? But there are certain things that you feel like, you know, I'd love for people to see Enchanted 2, you know, on a big screen. And who knows, that may still happen. It is right now planned for Disney Plus, but, you know, I think it's just, we're in such a fluid situation where everything's changing every day, right? So, you know, maybe that will happen. I don't know. Maybe they already have plans to have it in theaters as well. But, you know, these sort of big, these big movies where it's just like, they feel more epic, there's certain films that I feel like belong on a big screen, and maybe Enchanted isn't the best example of that, but like Sonic, even, you know, there's some amazing set pieces and action sequences and stuff that I feel like are a bit muted when you watch them at home.
Yeah, definitely.
That said, I mean, everyone's got their own home theaters now, right? With 70-inch TVs and surround sound and all that. So
if you want the kids back up, then you go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. If you're tired of parenting from home and the kids learning from home. I mean, I just have the utmost empathy for parents with, you know, small children over the last year. It's like, you know, just want to pull your hair out. I mean, it's testing everybody, but, and these kids too, having to, you know, not get their sort of social, but look, it's, you know, that's not to go into everything we've talked about over the last year. I know that's a tired conversation, but, I'm hopeful that, that we'll learn to live with it. And I think there's a landscape where we have some of the things that we had before, back to normal. I do see people going back to theaters again, and back to, you know, like Broadway theaters as well, right? You know, live shows. And I see streaming, you know, continuing to power forward and being a big force as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm always fascinated because, you know, LA is actually, you know, it's probably one of the top places I have really missed traveling to during the pandemic, because for me, that really has a unique creative energy. And again, whether you're into industrial design, automotive design, architecture, furniture, entertainment, music, whatever it is, I really struggle to think of a place in the world where there's a higher concentration of this sort of creative energy. And I'm just wondering yourself, in for you as an actor developing your career and developing your work, how much of an influence does this environment have in the end? And is it, I mean, you hear more and more now, of course, being shot in Europe and Ireland and London and all the rest of it, or across the borders, but how much does it help to be in such a melting pot of creativity? And do you feel that's had a major impact on how you develop professionally?
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, I feel like everyone has sort of, you know, redefined where you need to be for this business, right? We can be in our homes and like you said, there's a lot of runaway productions that go to Canada and Ireland and Australia. But there's something about being in, I will preface this by saying I moved to Austin, Texas a year ago, and it's something that an idea I'd been flirting with for a long time, is to get a little closer back to where I grew up. And I have some family and friends down there, and bought a place down there. And so with the idea of wanting something outside of Los Angeles, in addition to keeping my house here in LA as well. Yeah. So I'm a little, I wish I could say bi-coastal, but not, there's no real coast in Austin, Texas. Close. But it's something I'd been wanting to do for a long time, get a little closer to where my mom is. And that said, you know, over the last 30 years and over this last year, I, you know, continue to spend enormous amounts of time in Los Angeles. And there's something about, even though, you know, in the industry, you know, you hear people saying, yeah, you don't really have to be here anymore. You know, you can kind of live wherever and go where the work is. Mm-hmm. But there's something about, there's a vibe. There's something in the air. There's in Los Angeles here where you still feel like, I feel like when I'm in Texas or, you know, or Oklahoma or Boston or, you know, or Wyoming, wherever, you feel like something's missing. I'm missing something. And it's not like FOMO, like I'm like missing on going out on like events and premieres and things like that. It's just, there's an energy to this city and a creative energy to this city. And it fuels you, you know, it gets into your system, and it's a huge part of being here. It does make it more difficult to take your hat off at the end of the day and separate work from your home life, right? Because it can sort of start to seep into your, you know, into your home life. And that part's one thing you need to be really disciplined about is, you know, when you come home, really shutting off your work phones and your emails and stuff, and immersing yourself in your home life with your kids and all of that, which I find easier to do when I'm in Austin, to sort of shut off from the business parts of everything.
Yeah.
But it's inspiring. It was inspiring when I first arrived in 1993, seeing the Hollywood sign and driving Mulholland Drive and going to Beverly Hills for meetings with directors and, you know, going to the DGA for screenings. And it, you know, it's you're around people who are, as equally inspired, and you know, like minds, these creative minds, and it, you're, you know, sort of this part of this sort of amazing soup that's, you know, yeah. where great creative ideas, are born. And so it's a huge part of a source of inspiration for me, being actually in Los Angeles, and I'm here enough, I'm back and forth enough to get sort of recharged by that.
Mm. And then the balance in Austin is obviously a very nice thing to have as well. Being closer to family, that's definitely one thing we notice as well. It's just also really been a thing, I think, the last year.
Yeah.
Has brought out that everybody sort of realized, okay, who are the people that are actually grounding me? Where do I feel at home?
And, right.
You know, so it's also very nice to buy a nice place next to that annoying guy from high school.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Hey, remember me?
Yeah, remember me? That guy you took the makeup back in 1986. Right, right.
Yeah.
Look at my drive.
Yeah. Remember all that stuff you wrote on the windshield of my Honda? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here I am. Yeah, no, it's true. And for my children too, you know, you do, there is, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with Los Angeles, you know, I've been here for a long time, and there's so many wonderful things about the city, and it's really unique, you know, but I could lose the traffic, and I could lose being feeling like you're sort of on top of each other, and there's so much concrete, and you know, I wanted the opportunity for my children to be able to get away and be immersed in nature and you know, go out on the lake and learn how to water ski, and so that was another sort of, you know, motivating thing for me to have a place there. But, you know, again, we're all in, you know, in this sort of, you know, nomadic state at the moment, where we're feeling like that right now everything feels a little bit experimental, and, you know, everyone sort of
the office is dead. Not everybody back in the office. The office is dead.
Right.
No, it's all about
exactly.
Everybody can go back and Starbucks.
Imagine.
No, they can't.
It's like, right. Yeah, right. So you just kind of roll with it and go, hey, look, nothing's irreversible. These decisions you're making. And you know, if it works out that we need to be back in Los Angeles, then, you know, we will.
Absolutely.
But anyway, but yeah, LA is just, you know, you talked about architecture. That's something I love as well. And you know, we don't always take the best care of our architecture here. A lot of amazing buildings have been torn down and replaced with condos. But, but Richard Neutra and some of these, Lautner, some of these amazing architects for homes, you find them sort of peppered throughout the Hollywood Hills, and it's just nice to see. Yeah. It's an inspiring city to drive around if you're not stuck in traffic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's always been the reason for me to do my early morning runs whenever I go traveling, because especially when you're trying to design spaces that kind of need to work in an environment, you need to kind of feel the spirit of the place. And for me, that always happens when you start going around residential areas and you look at, okay, how do people live, furniture, styling, you know, how do they do their gardens? What are they obviously aspiring to, from how they express their own identity, what cars are they driving, and what cafes do they go to, what's the supermarkets like? You know, all the sort of the stuff that gives you a feel for how people actually live on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's just absolutely key. You know, I always struggled really to design remotely. And this was one of the things during the pandemic, we did two flagship store designs actually here as a team, from really far away, and it's places I've been to a million times, like Dubai, you know, and then you make so many mistakes until you go back there. And I remember the first trip back out, and you stand in the space and you just think this is all wrong, you know, and then you start again, and you look at people, you see what's changed, and some stuff has changed amazingly quickly. And I noticed that going back to London now, how much London has changed the retail mix, you know, what's going out, what's coming in. Mm-hmm. It's a completely changed place compared to a year and a half ago. And that's, you've got to be there and take it in and feel it to connect back with what you're actually doing.
Right. And I think that's key, right? There's certain things we can do over Zoom and from home digitally. And there's certain sort of like tactile, tangible things that you have to actually physically be there to take in that energy and especially if you're an artist, you know, if you're a creative person, like you want to be surrounded by that. And I think that's, you know, not to go back to the theater thing, but that's one of the things that I think is going to be a lifeline for theaters, is people are going to miss that, you know, shared experience of, like, you know, you're in a room full of strangers watching the same content and you're laughing at the same jokes. You don't, you've never seen them before in your life. It's just something about that energy, you know?
Yeah.
And in Los Angeles, it does have, it has that energy about it, which can inspire you. Drive down Sunset Boulevard and you see these massive buildings with, you know, posters for new movies coming out or shows, and you're like, oh yeah, I love that actor. I'm glad he's, I want to see that. And I don't know. It's good to be around physically, to be in that space, like you said.
A buzz. Well, we touched on Boston very briefly earlier, and of course we were, you know, very, very honored and delighted that you agreed to playing our founder, Florentine Ariosto Jones, in that retelling of IWC's founding story in a sort of personal format. We tried to get away from the idea of a pure advertising film of a glorified history and actually showing the personal journey of F.A. Jones. And again, I knew from the beginning when we first had the discussion, I knew you were the absolute spot on right actor to play Jones. In fact, I couldn't imagine anybody else for that.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say.
And you did it, I mean, absolute justice. I mean, it blew me away. And still to the present day, I can show this movie anywhere I want, in any meeting with any partners. It's goosebumps. There's absolute silence during the 2.5 minutes. And that's a long time for, you know, what is a promotional video at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
To get people's attention for this amount of time, and for actually to be everybody be absolutely silent and actually take it in, and you can see it. There are moments. I think when you're on screen, when you say to your on-screen wife, you know, did I dream too far, or something like that.
And did I dream too big?
I dream too big? Never. And still, I get goosebumps every single time.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's a very different thing because it's kind of a corporate production. We try to make it a bit sort of more drama looking, but how's that for you? A very different type of character to play.
Well, first of all, like you said, it didn't feel like anything that was a corporate, you know, advertisement or anything. It was an exquisitely made, just stunningly beautiful, you know, piece of art. And it was, I was, first of all, just absolutely taken aback and honored to be invited to be a part of this and to play your founder. That's just, you know how much of a fan I am of IWC and its history. And I respect it so much. And to be able to, you know, step into his shoes and portray him in such a beautifully made short film, essentially, you know, was a real joy for me. So I'm very proud of that piece of work and honored to have been asked to play him. Like you said, it didn't feel, you know, it felt like we were making a film, in which we were. It was, the sort of cinematic element to it, going back in time to the late 1800s and it was just beautifully, beautifully shot. So I'm very happy with how it turned out and feel very lucky to have played him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're beyond thrilled with it, and it's going to last for many, many years. And I think it's one of the cornerstones for us really to explain to new clients what the unique founding story of IWC is. And here we have a 27-year-old who came over from Boston, took a total risk and bet on a place he didn't know, he didn't speak the language of, coming over and trying to, you know, I know at the best of times, even today, how difficult it is to come to a rural Switzerland or anywhere rural Europe and sort of make your mark as a complete outsider. You know, it's not easy at the best of times. But in those days, you know, with the language and cultural barriers that must have existed to set up a real piece of American industrial architecture here and introduce an American system of watchmaking to what was essentially before a system of farmers assembling clocks and watches in homework, you know, which was by the fireside in long winter evenings. And I think there's this pub scene, the bar scene, I think that captured that really nicely, where that gentleman is looking at you and go, here's the American who wants to explain to the Swiss how to make watches. And you know, everybody sort of roars with laughter. And it must have been like that. And for Jones to actually turn this around and actually make 10,000 watch movements in a platform system in year one and export them to Brooklyn where they're encased and sold in America. I mean, this guy, you know, that was a bold move.
Yeah, right. Well, so we talked earlier in the podcast about just having the sort of, you know, blind courage and determination to achieve something, to identify a need and dream bigger than you think is even achievable at the time. It's just, that's something I wanted to capture with the character portrayal, which is his determination. And he was such a visionary. And like you said, he brought these American production methods to met with Swiss watchmaking skills. And, you know, and it was not, it was a massive mountain to climb, right? I mean, just against all odds. And I thought that I wanted that to be at the sort of, you know, the core of his drive, was just this sheer, you know, unabashed and unrelenting determination and tenacity and that entrepreneurial spirit that was his engine, you know, and that's what inspired me about playing the role. I did as much research as I could have on Jones and wanted to do it justice, the portrayal. But yeah, we talked earlier about me moving to Los Angeles and like, this is, you know, how do you do this? You know, and I was 19 and he was 27, but I was just young enough to be, it took a certain, degree of boldness and courage to go head on into something and basically will it to happen. And I see the same thing with F.A. Jones's story, which is this will not be a failure. I will succeed at this. I will overcome this adversity and whatever challenges are thrown at me because I believe in this idea. And how do I get this idea that's in my head manifested into a reality? And he achieved that. Yeah. And that's just the inspiration behind any success story. And it's epitomized in his story in this film.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that when we had the discussions about the early versions of the film. And often I was asked, okay, in the end, there's a scene where Zeta Jones, you know, gets up and walks out and everybody stands up and sort of looks at him. And then it says, okay, he returns to America. He never, you know, worked in watchmaking again. And people then said, yeah, but I mean, you can't show that. I mean, it's a total utter failure. And I was like, well, here we are, 150 years later, International Watch Company in the same building he built back in 1876, I think he built this building. I'm essentially still sitting in his office.
Right.
We have the exact continuity of that same brand name and being a global watch brand today. So how can you call that a failure?
Well, which says just as much about what he created, which says just as much about who he was as a human being as well. Mm. Like that scene specifically just gave me chills just thinking about it. Yeah. He stands up and he might think of himself as in that moment, I failed at something. But he turns around and there he sees everyone that has been just following him and inspired by him and the lasting impact of that, right? As he walks out the door, that wasn't the end of something. That actually was the beginning of something there. And like you said, it turned into here we are today talking about IWC.
Yeah.
All because of him.
Yeah. Multiple owners over the year, two world wars, the quartz crisis, you know, the reinvention of mechanical watches. I mean, all these setbacks on the way. And I think in many ways, I like to tell that story with all of its edges and bumps, because I find it so much more interesting than this idealized story of success. You know, there
we are,
came with a grand plan and, you know, implemented ever since. And it's like,
No. Yeah. Every story is more interesting when it's just truthfully told. And that's life, right? That's the sort of human element of the whole thing, which is, you know, you're not living life unless you experience a setback or make a mistake, or, you know, that's how you grow. That's how you learn and how you ultimately get tested to push harder. And so I love that you don't, you know, tell the story in this sort of idealized way and glossy way, right? It's like there were setbacks, there were challenges, there were investors that did not believe in his vision, and I'm sure, and there were moments where he even is, you know, in the privacy of his own home with his wife, second guessing himself, right? In that beautiful scene you just detailed, and I think that just makes it so much more relatable to a human being, right? It's like, I've been in those moments before where I've questioned, you know, my ability or my talent or my vision.
Monday morning, and, 6 a.m.
Right. it's why you succeed, my friend. What is it? It's some quote, like, the greater the artist, the greater the doubt.
Yeah. I'm not cutting my ear off yet.
Yeah. Right.
Of course, the film was shot, I mean, a little film was shot in sort of a trailer-like format. And of course, many people have asked me since when the whole series is actually going to launch.
Oh, that's great.
A valid point. So I think we've got something to get back there post-pandemic and sort of yeah. finish it off. You know,
let's turn it into a series streaming Disney Plus. Let's do it.
Absolutely, 100%.
And in theaters, and in theaters.
To our listeners, what should they look out for in over the next couple of months? Where to look out for James?
Oh, good question. I'm in LA at the moment. I think I've discussed a few of them, but we're hoping to finish the third season of Dead to Me on Netflix. Yeah. I don't know when that's coming out, but everything is so up in the air, and we're ready to release something, and then it's put on hold. I think they just put Mission Impossible on hold with Tom Cruise, or maybe I got that wrong. Maybe it's the Bond film. Yeah, right. Yes, you're familiar with that, aren't you? I don't have specific dates, but I'm thinking early next year we're going to see, hopefully we're going to see the sequel to Sonic, which will be coming back out, and be a lot of fun, and hopefully get people back into theaters as well. And the third season of Dead to Me, third and final season.
And then you're literally dead to us in the end.
And then I'm dead to everybody on Dead to Me. Yes, that's it. Final. And in much to your daughter's hopefully joy and happiness, to be Enchanted 2 will be next year as well. So those are the ones coming out soon. The films that were released this year, I lent my voice to Boss Baby 2, which is the sequel to the original Boss Baby with Alec Baldwin. So it was me and Alec Baldwin having fun over the last 2 years doing voice work, which that was an interesting thing too, because we were doing our vocal work in the studios at DreamWorks. And when the pandemic hit, we had to do our best but that's, if it's just vocal work, you're having to, I created this little, makeshift home recording studio booth, which I'm not in right now, if you hear any echo, but because it was constructed of three mattresses and a duvet covering the top of it.
To your dad, yes. Want to go to bed? Not now. Exactly. I'm in the middle of the crucial scene.
Exactly. And leaf blowers going on in my house, next door, God, gardeners.
Don't get me started on leaf blowers.
Worst.
Regular listeners will know this is my sore topic. This is my Achilles heel. Oh. Show me a leaf blower and I will lose the plot.
Well, that is one of the instruments that you'll hear in the orchestra of Los Angeles nonstop, right? If you're talking about leaf blowers, you must have been doing Zooms with people in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Because it's everywhere here.
Outside my office. I don't need to go
anywhere.
Kidding,
really?
Rain, sunshine, any weather condition, even if it's gale force winds out there, there will be people blowing leaves from one end of the path to the other for no apparent purpose whatsoever, right, apart from revving this thing. And can't they even just let it run? No, it's got to go.
Yes. Thank you for saying that. I have a conversation I want to have with my neighbor that I just want to walk across the street and say, just hold it down for one consistent note, like, and then it's just white noise.
Yeah. But you should release guidelines. Guidelines on leaf blower utilization, definitely. Listen, James Marsden's neighbor, no more revving of the leaf blower, okay?
Don't rev it. Just get the job done. Just hold it. Are you trying to save power? What are you doing? You're just blowing a leaf around.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're sitting here talking about innovation. When I think of innovation, I think of IWC. Can IWC come up with some sort of silent leaf blower, please?
Absolutely. I think probably Mr. Dyson or Elon Musk or somebody would probably do that.
Someone
in
will
electric.
Do it. Yeah. Yeah. We need it. We need it.
Silent leaf destructor. Or we could just pick them up like in the olden days, you know?
Oh, please. Can we go back to some of that, right?
Yeah. A rake.
Rake the leaves. Yes. It's going to be more therapeutic for you than revving this annoying engine.
I know. And it's especially bad here because we have, you literally have to be careful now, but we've got a monastery next door, which is an ancient building that is sort of 3-4 floors high. And there,
oh my God. So you have complete silence in a monastery.
Have complete echo. We have complete echo.
Oh, you have echo.
Our building is sort of a sheer wall, 4 floors high. And then next door is the same. And in the middle, you've got a cobbled street. So this is great if you have a very nice sounding engine. Not so great if you have to listen to, anything going on the street, including sort of window cleaners on these lifting platforms, anything like that. Because
trucks backing up.
Echo, yeah.
Yeah.
or then people pulling a pallet trolley over cobbles, which is also an absolute classic. While you're on that Zoom call, and it just goes.
Anyway, we digress. We digress.
On that bombshell. Now, listen, James, it's been an absolute pleasure. We can't wait to see you in all of the things that are coming up. Thank you for being such a fantastic friend and supporter of IWC over years. I can't wait to have you back, hopefully, enjoying all of the things we've changed in watchmaking, actually, in Schaffhausen since you came last. You'd be absolutely delighted to see what's been going on in the meantime.
And I can't wait. It's one of the things I miss the most, is seeing everybody, seeing all the IWC family, and, you know, flying out to see you all at Watches of Wonders and actually, you know, sharing time together. I just really miss it. And I hope we get to see each other in person soon.
We will. Thank you so much.
Terrific.
Thank you for joining us today. That was super interesting. And thanks to all our listeners. We'll be back with another episode next week. This was James Marsden. Go check out his work and tune in next time. You can listen to all of the episodes, of course, on the app. You get all of the ads there, and speak to you in the next episode. Thanks for now.